Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. Glad you're with us today. Our goal here is to bring you credible and valid information and insights from diverse members of our community. Central Coast Voices wants to address how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community and how we look at the long-term ramifications of change, and I have to paraphrase with change or lack of change in some cases in our society. For those of you who've been listening for the last few weeks, you may know what direction we're going in today. For those of you who haven't, there's been a series of programs that we've been part of, and that is there's been a large national poll done by NPR, which was asking people about their personal experience with discrimination. The program was really much discrimination in America, experiences and views of Americans. And this has been an ongoing project we've been doing here as on Central Coast Voices as part of and in conjunction with that NPR project. Today's topic is the last in this series. I thank both those of you who've been listening for many weeks now and those who've participated in the discussion. But the last topic we bring up today is basically discrimination in America and the experiences, views of American women. While we've had a lot of gender-based discrimination issues coming up with regard to sexual harassment, and that's a topic that came up and became mostly in the forefront after this study was done, so it was not a primary focus. As most of you know, I don't know how else to put this. I don't like the terminology unless it's necessarily as a way to explain it, but the hashtag MeToo movement, which has become in the forefront, and this week, I believe actually technically yesterday, became the person of the year for Time magazine. I don't know quite how you have a movement as a person of the year, but they get to decide editorially what they want to do. So that's really where we're going with this, is looking at some issues that have become in the foreground recently and this study as a long-term issue. 68% of women in the United States believe they have been discriminated against. This is not 68% of women who believe discrimination exists, because this study was looking at personal experiences. So it wasn't asking the people who participated in the study for their opinion about how it affected other people. The discussion really was how it affected them. So 68% of the women in the United States who were studied with a survey deviation of, I believe, about 2.5 to 3%, said they have experienced discrimination in the society they live in, and that's America. And that's what we're here to talk about today. I have three wonderful guests here. Some of them have been on the program before. Others are new to our listeners. And Betsy Nash, who for many of you going back many years, and I have to mention this because if I don't, it's just kind of the thing we don't talk about. Betsy was a local radio person of 30-plus years ago that she and I worked together with on a number of projects. She is now a human resources professional, and she's the founder. And what year was it founded in?
1978.
The founding president of the San Luis Obispo County Women's Network. She's with us today, and her background at this point is primarily in human resources, and she has some fascinating things to share with us.
Thanks, Fred.
Okay. Heidi Harmon, who is the mayor of San Luis Obispo. Are you the third female mayor of San Luis, or are you the fourth female?
I believe I'm the third.
The third, okay.
Yeah. How sad that it's single digits. How long has San Luis been? Excuse me, can I butt in here?
You always will anyway.
Yeah, that's you can thing. Count them on one hand.
Maybe you should be next.
Oh, that ship has sailed. Thank you.
Okay, this is going to be a lively discussion. Okay. And Dr. Lizzie Lamory. Okay, I knew I was going to do that wrong even after we talked about it anyway. She's a lecturer on women and gender studies and ethnic studies at Cal Poly. And she actually has a lot of specialty in the issues of workplace-related labor-related of discrimination.
My specialization is U.S. labor history.
Okay.
So I may take the conversation back a few years.
Good. I think that's absolutely true. Okay. If we hadn't chained women and children to sewing machines and then locked the door,
Welcome to the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. No, that's okay. The Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire.
If we hadn't done that, then we wouldn't have needed unions, and we wouldn't have needed all these employment laws. We've been terrible to our employees for hundreds of years.
By the way, that was Betsy. Okay. Before we get too far into this, let me just remind people of a few things that I seem to forget very often, and that is this is a call-in program. If you would like to call in and participate in the discussion, the phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. I would encourage you to do that early in the program. We seem to, on a regular basis, get some people who are frustrated that we can't get their call-in in the last 6 or 7 minutes of the program. So I want to remind you that if you want to be part of that discussion, that we really basically have you join us as soon as you can. Betsy, I'm just going to let you take over. It's okay. That's okay. Harassing you has always been fun to do, but on a different personal level. I want to look at some key issues, and that is the fact that 68% of women feel like they have experienced some discrimination in their life. That number doesn't surprise me. What surprises me is where the other 38% are that when studied basically say they've not experienced any discrimination as women in any environment. And because the study doesn't say is not about have you had sexual harassment issues, have you had workplace issues, have you had domestic violence issues. It basically is have you been discriminated against in some way because you are a woman in our society. And we have 38% of our population in this country that says they haven't. I'm wondering where they live.
I find that really hard to believe. And they just may not be awake to it or recognizing it or ready to address it. But I don't know if it would be fair to say that 100% of women have experienced discrimination. But I think often we're discriminated against and we don't always realize it. So I would suspect that the number is, in fact, a lot higher. And maybe the professor has, you know, better data. But I find that really hard to believe. And maybe I know that oftentimes young women will express that they don't recognize being discriminated against or express that they haven't been discriminated against. And often you hear an older woman say, well, wait till you get into workforce. Or sometimes it takes more of those types of intersections or experiences to recognize it. But it seems like it's so systemic that and it manifests itself in many forms.
Very good point. Lizzie, because you focus on labor history, I'm curious, do you think we are seeing a consistent representation of what discrimination for women is in the United States over the last 100 years? Is it, oh, gee, it's a lot better than it was 10 or 20 years ago, but we just have a long way to go?
If I could just step back and respond to the mayor's point there. A couple of weeks ago, I was actually in a class talking with students at Cal Poly about the way in which they view discrimination on campus, for example, and how I posed the question, how many of you engage in policing where you are at night, what you wear in certain social environments, how you move about public space on campus, depending on the time of day or the activity. And nearly all of the women raised their hands, and I don't believe any of the men in the class raised their hands. And I framed it as this is an example of gender discrimination and that they had not recognized that as being so prevalent in their life. And so I think that there are many ways in which people don't recognize it, don't understand that it's not just the way it is, that it doesn't have to be that way, but that this is gender discrimination. And then to your point, I think that there is a very powerful narrative in the United States about how, as a country, we are always getting better. We are always continually working towards fixing those wrongs in our society, that it's a linear path that we are on towards progress. And I think that that is a problematic narrative. I think that it's far more complicated than that at best. And at more cynical times, I would say that that is incorrect. And so when it comes to topics like sexual harassment, discrimination, that this idea that it's constantly getting better is deeply flawed.
I attempt to stay out of partisan politics in this discussion as best I can. I think that what both of you and Heidi have said at this point brings up something that provokes my frustration, and I'm wondering whether or not it's part of this discussion. There seems to be this – maybe they're part of the 38%, and this is – I'm trying to be careful not to be too facetious, but I may not be able to do that. I'm wondering if the 38% who believe there's not discrimination against women all happen to live in Alabama and believe that all of the women who have basically said that a person running for the Senate there who is they consider to be a sexual predator, all of the people who have accused him are just liars. And most of the people who are referring to them as liars are women, at least what I'm hearing and seeing, and I follow political dialogue a lot.
Fred, I think that's a great point. I think that there's a culture in the United States, and I think it's more prevalent in the more conservative areas and the more religious, you know, evangelical Christian areas, that says women belong, you know, barefoot and in the kitchen still, and should not be competing with men. They should be home raising the children, and God, Jesus, that would be terrific if we could all decide who in our family could do that and not have to live on two salaries. But so I think that's part of the reason we have 38% showing here. I think another reason is because everywhere you're going to have people that are on one side going, oh, I don't care. Just treat me any way you want, you know, especially with sexual harassment. I can take anything, you know. And then people on the other end of the spectrum saying, don't even think about touching me, and or being really, really aware of any sort of discrimination stuff. And the courts have even decided that right there in the middle someplace there's this reasonable person, used to be called a reasonable man. You know, this reasonable person theory or something that where you go, well, okay, but there's someplace reasonable in the middle here. So I think probably a lot of the people that were asked about discrimination were oblivious to it or thought, well, it's just, that's the way it goes. It wasn't a problem for me.
I think it might be helpful, too, at least it would be for me and maybe for our listeners, to separate a little bit or understand the difference between acts of discrimination and just misogyny and what might be called toxic masculinity that we experience in the culture. When I'm hearing discrimination, I'm imagining an act that is either for or against me based on my gender. And I think a lot of what's going on in addition to that, they're all tangled up together, is that this country in particular and the world to some extent is really suffering from misogyny and in this country in particular, really just the toxicness of certain aspects of masculinity. And that applies to all the genders. We all are part of that. Have become so detrimental. And I think that this plays out too as the way we treat our women in this country is not different from the way we treat the environment in this country, for example, or the way we treat the economy and the financial system. This sort of competitive, win at all costs, those types of approaches that are traditionally associated more with a masculine approach that I think are also really important to acknowledge and address as a sort of a wider systemic issue. So while some people may not be conscious of a intended act of discrimination against them, I think it would be impossible to suggest that all of us, men included, are not suffering from misogyny in this country.
That's a very good point. And as you're mentioning that, it occurred to me that one of the best representations that I'm aware of lack of equal treatment between men and women in our society goes back to a topic that we could probably debate and argue a lot of elements of for a long time, but it's basically prostitution. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I mention it is because if you and I are involved in a drug transaction and I'm selling you drugs and you're buying drugs from me, the legal system in this country is prone to treat both of us equally. Mm. We're both going to get arrested. We're both going to get our names in the newspaper. To this day, if a female is practicing prostitution and gets arrested for basically selling sex for money, the likelihood is the person who is the purchaser is still going to walk out the door with their name showing up nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I don't know, that's going back thousands of years.
Sure.
That's probably been the way it's been addressed. I actually, as I saw some changes and trends in the early 70s where all of a sudden Johns were getting their names listed
yeah.
until they became embarrassing
right.
for people of power, that went on, and we have pretty much gone back to the same thing, which is if the woman is the perpetrator, it's a crime. If the man's the participation or perpetrator or co-perpetrator, it was just a man thing.
Well, and in that context especially, women's bodies have traditionally been the property of the men in their lives. And so especially when it comes to sex, that's been the traditional relationship. We see that as it manifests itself in this sexual harassment moment, which of course is the longest moment in history. It's been going on since the beginning of time. I feel pretty certain about that.
Right.
You know,
right.
But it's coming out into the fore of the cultural conversation. But you know, women's bodies still to this day do not, as a cultural norm, really belong to us. We see this as it manifests itself in reproductive health and as it manifests itself in sexual harassment. So especially when it comes to something like prostitution, that's really clear.
And it's also insidious. It's so subconscious. When I deal with this in the workplace all the time, I just finished a training just now a few minutes ago on sexual harassment prevention in the workplace, and you have to bring up this consciousness about women's bodies are not your business, men. You have to bring all that up into the consciousness so that they will understand that they need to look at all those assumptions,
mm-hmm.
and then you tell them, okay, now that you've thought of it, stop it.
Right.
Stop it.
And women's bodies are not your business, women, either. Because I think that's really clear, too, that, as I said, you know, we're all suffering from misogyny, men included, and women are, I guess if perpetrators is the right word of it, they're just as much participating. I feel like in my own personal experience, some of the most misogynistic comments and attitudes I've personally received are from women.
Well, are they trying to not appear to be socially inept? Are they trying to look like one of the good old boys? Are they trying to, I mean, what can, do you remember what you think the motivation was?
For example, when women judge other women on how they look, right, and make comments about that, you know, and being a public person in my particular role, I experience a fair amount of that.
Sure.
And that's just a very small example. But I think that I think it'd be really easy, and definitely I'm sure we've all had moments, I know I have, where we want to really demonize men at this moment. And it's really easy to do that. And every day we wake up and hear another example of why that should be okay. But the men are really suffering too, and I just think that there's an opportunity here to make it better for everyone, and that we're all really victims, if you will, of this misogynistic culture.
I want to get back to that. I want to remind folks, though, we're having a discussion. We're talking about, among other things, the study that NPR did that's related to discrimination in the United States. And today, the subgroup we are dealing with, as far as the study is concerned, is discrimination that involves women. And if you want to be part of this discussion, the phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. We want you to have an opportunity to put your two cents in if you like, or if you have a question or an observation about where this is going that you'd like to share. Lizzie, I stepped on you continuing that while I put in our little plug here, so go ahead.
I was going to say that there is some research that talks about why women participate in misogyny. And so to some extent, it can be that they are trying to sort of blend into the good old boys club.
Right.
One of the functions of being a token in any sort of work environment is to emphasize difference, is to constantly emphasize that which is different so as to make that person potentially more accessible to hostile work environment. But on the other hand, there are women who participate in misogyny as a way to distance themselves from that display of power. So if those women had participated in the proper gender expectations, those women would not have exposed themselves to harassment or to violence. And so by participating in misogyny, many women feel that they are going to protect themselves, that they will – that that in upholding those – that discriminatory behavior or those ideas about gender differences, then they are protecting themselves and putting the blame on the other women and really distancing themselves from the way in which power functions in society. Trying to create that distance then makes them feel safer.
Is that a socialization thing? I mean, you want to distance yourself from the people that are making waves because you were taught not to make waves?
I expect, yes, it would be part of the social – it's a coping mechanism, right? So we are socialized into certain gender roles, and then how do we cope with the inequality that comes from those gender roles? And I would say that that's one way that some people cope.
I think Heidi made a great point, too, if I can jump back in, Fred. Because you talk about we're all victims of it. And the men are certainly victims of stereotypes, too. I worry that we're continuing to raise girls who are taught to be subservient, if you will, taking care of people and nurturers and all this, and who are still afraid to raise their hand in school to answer a question until they're absolutely sure they got it right. And we're continuing to raise boys who are told, be strong, don't cry, you know, go for it, you know, survival of the fittest, you got to blah, 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 rise up on the ladder, all of that. So we're perpetuating still some of these stereotypes that make it harder and harder for somebody later when they get a consciousness to break out of them.
And maybe this is why like the millennials, I would say, I have a 24-year-old daughter and a 22-year-old son who are very much aware and in a group of peers that continue to move away from gender norms. It seems like every day I talk to them, there's new terms. There's my son wants to be referred to in a non-gendered binary way. He's not trans in any way. He's just not wanting to be associated with any gender anymore. Huh. And a lot of their friends is somewhere along the gender fluidity spectrum, if you will. It seems like there's a lot of reasons why that's probably happening, but this is probably one of them. As a way of acknowledging that, really questioning what is gender, how sort of real is gender, and what works in terms of having a thriving, you know, community and society, and is our commitment to gender norms really constructive and helpful?
Yeah, I think the overall discussion we're having that's focusing on the fact that it harms that any kind of discrimination in this area doesn't just harm women, it harms everybody.
Yes,
I think is very important, and I don't want to move off that topic, and I want to add a but, if you will. I'm a 66-year-old adult white male. I see myself as reasonably harmless. But the rest of the world probably sees me as rather loud and obnoxious, and that's okay. But what I'm getting at is I'm aware when I travel professionally to conferences and things like that, when my wife and I travel together, we are treated differently than when I travel alone. The flip side is I have a lot of colleagues because I'm part of a larger organization. I'm aware that when women travel alone in professional circles versus having a partner with them, regardless of who the partner is, they tend to be treated the same way. And because my experience is that if there's anybody in a social circle or a professional circle and you don't know them, and one of them is a loud adult male, that's likely to be one of the most dangerous people in the room. And so the ability to make friends or develop friendships with colleagues when I'm traveling by myself is drastically different than when I'm traveling with my spouse. And so I think we are all harmed by that issue of how you're seen in society. And, you know, if you're seen as the more likely to be the bully, more likely to be the overassertive one, more likely to be the dangerous one, that may indeed be part of the discussion that that makes that balance. The pendulum swings in ways that aren't always fair, and I don't know how we address that.
Well, it seems like there's aspects of traditional masculinity, for lack of a better way of talking about it, that are really inherently isolating. And it seems like we have a huge crisis of masculinity, and a big part of that is just deep, deep loneliness, mm-hmm. that it seems like men in general are really deeply experiencing. And then it manifests itself in these, at times, very dangerous ways. I mean, as you look across this country and in our recent history, these larger acts of violence are almost all committed by men, mostly young men, mostly young white men, who seem to be really feeling isolated, having that challenge of connection that you're talking about, haven't been able to build that bridge between themselves and meaningful relationships. And in rare cases, but in really important cases that definitely impact people's lives, it manifests itself in this extreme violence, and not to mention all the sexual violence that's happening every day. And so it seems like that, and you know, what I feel uncomfortable with is having a conversation here with three women and talking about women and discrimination and focusing still on men, right? So that's part of what this conversation is. And though it seems to me that that there's a crisis there, that I think it's important, at least that's something I'm working on, is trying to have an awareness about that, while we also, as women, do what we can to take up our own space and to bring other women up with us.
I think that it's a very valid point, and I was trying to think about how to steer around the concern I wanted to share without it becoming a man's concern. Mm-hmm. To defend that a little bit, I'd have to observe that in any environment where you have discrimination, those who are discriminated against, a good portion of their discrimination is caused by someone outside of their own group, and therefore the most powerful are indeed the most dangerous of our society. And so we can't ignore – we've talked about African-American discrimination. Mm-hmm. We can't have that discussion without talking about slavery. We can't have that discussion without talking about second-class citizenship that goes back 200 years. So it's a hard thing to balance out, I think, sometimes.
Well, the whole discrimination issue, just like the sexual harassment portion of discrimination, is about power. And I think what you're saying is that you need the people in power to see the point of the people who are subjected to the discrimination as well. Without the people in power to make some changes and to make it okay to speak up about these things and okay to have the same pay or okay to have equal access to education, whatever the discrimination might be. If the people in power don't go along with it, it's certainly not going to happen.
That's a good issue to bring up, Betsy, because that's also an issue that I think is probably very paramount to what you do. I mean, for those of us, we haven't talked a whole lot about everybody's background at the table, but you spend a number of years as a human resources regional manager for Home Depot, which I would have to say is probably, I mean, the hardware store environment is a man's environment. I suspect you probably had a lot of people you dealt with issues of discrimination and better awareness in the workplace who I would classify as probably the worst perpetrators who were the ones who believed they were not part of the problem at all.
Sure, sure. We all have our blind spots. Yeah. We're all egocentric. You know, we've only got these twin turrets, I've heard them, our eyes, for which to judge things. The amount of empathy we have helps us to understand other people's perspectives. But for the most part, that's a lot of work. And so we do naturally just see things from our perspective. It's funny you bring up Home Depot. I was a district manager for Bed Bath & Beyond, so I don't want anybody who works for Home Depot to think I was regional manager. No.
Okay.
I had one store. But in 92, when I was hired, they were under a ruling from, I forget what you call it, a ruling from the courts that said, you got to get your act together, because there was a discrimination lawsuit brought against them. And they said, you have to do these certain things. You have to have X amount of training and stuff. So everybody was very conscious of it at the time. And this is 92. Okay, they were saying, let's hire some women to work in the hardware department. And they didn't have very much trouble finding women who could work in the hardware department, but they hadn't been looking. And a lot of women hadn't thought to apply because they didn't think they had a choice. They didn't think they had a prayer for it. So that culture has definitely changed through the years, I'm happy to say. Some of my best stories are from Bed Bath & Beyond. I had 12 stores there.
Wait, a couple of best stories are fine here.
Are they really okay?
Yeah, go ahead, Betsy.
Oh, you know, I don't know. Because they're just – you just want to shake your head or hit yourself on the forehead and say, what are you thinking? People who – a supervisor walked by a woman sitting down at – or just another coworker. She wasn't his direct report. And she said, what did you just do to me? And he said, what are you talking about? I just walked by. She said, no, you touched my breast. And he came over. I'm going to show on you. Let the cameras reveal.
This is radio. Okay.
If I had wanted to touch your breast, I would have done this. And reaches over and puts his hand on her breast and leaves it there for some time. Now, I hear you all going, excuse me? What was he thinking? Well, he said that the line had moved and he thought it was probably okay. He thought they were joking around because they had gone out for lunch the day before and all this stuff. This is complicated stuff. But you still got to know that the line is drawn before you get close to touching somebody's breast or grabbing private parts. Excuse me? I mean, it's the – oh, I'm sorry. I'm agog.
Well, don't apologize for being uppity, as your book says there, and outraged, right? I mean, and maybe what Betsy's alluding to, I think, is really the – underlying thread of what's going on in this moment, and that is the complete vacuum in all forms of leadership, but I would say it's hard to say which one, but definitely when it comes to women's issues that we have in the so-called federal government now.
We've been told that it's just idle locker room talk. Why are we worried about it?
Yeah.
I want to make it real clear. That's what's been said. That is not what I am defending second.
And good luck finding somebody who agrees with that. Nobody's going to agree with that who I know.
Well, and
half the people in Alabama might.
I know.
The positive outcome, though, is the movement and the energy and the percolation and the revealing of all of these concerns. You know, a lot has been said about, you know, when the apocalypse is coming or what have you. And most people know, because it gets talked about a lot, that really the word apocalypse is a lifting of the veil, right? That's the word. That's the intention of the word. And I really see that right now. You know, maybe this is what the apocalypse actually looks like, that the lifting of the veil of toxic masculinity, the lifting of the veil of how we're treating the environment, the lifting of all and capitalism and all of these things, all these systems that are breaking down, the veil on all these systems is, to me, really lifting the unworkable nature of all these systems kind of colliding at once. And we're seeing that. And the upside is that people, and especially women in the past year, are really standing up and saying, no more are we going to be treated this way. We have a right to be here, and we have a right, especially you're seeing this more and more, to share our voice. And so that is a real positive outcome. And I'm hopeful that in the end, we are moving towards a more fair and just and sustainable world.
Well, it's in everybody's best interest. We could have cured cancer with all of the women who were not allowed equal access to education or to jobs or whatever.
And nobody's going to say that women are perfect, right? And if we had more women in power, that it would be a perfect world. But I think it would be fair to say if we had some parity and equality, it would potentially be considerably better. And I think that when women do better, everyone does better.
Yes.
When you have different voices that are all being heard, as opposed to one predominant loud side of something, you're better off.
And right. Do we think that a woman, generally speaking, right, and these are all, it's still adhering to some traditional gender norms, right? But I have a hard time imagining a matriarchal culture constantly threatening nuclear war, for example.
Have any of you ever heard the term uppity used in reference to a male?
No, they're already up.
Okay. All right. Because and what comes to mind, and again, it's difficult with this topic to not get somewhat political, and it's not a big, dark, deep, dark secret.
It's a
where
huge,
I fit.
Very political issue. So,
I believe that if Hillary Clinton had been a man, some of the things that a large portion of the population found offensive about her delivery would have been seen as attributes.
Fred, that's a big duh.
Well,
yes.
It's not great enlightenment on my part, but it isn't discussed very much.
I think if Hillary had been allowed to be Hillary from the beginning, whatever that ended up looking like for her, she would probably be president of the United States right now. And I think I have a lot of empathy for her. And to me, what I see with her, and I'm definitely not an expert on her, but she had been wanting, you know, had aspirations and skills to be in the political space. But in the time that she came up right. and the world that she was in, she was forced essentially to do it from a masculine approach. And I think that you could see, at least my impression is that there was a real lack of authenticity that you constantly heard people saying about her. And maybe that was part of it, that she wasn't really allowed to be her full self. She was pushed into this world that is so traditionally masculine that she was kind of coming at it from a masculine way. And therefore, I think didn't resonate with people the way she otherwise would have if she could have been her authentic self.
You know history really well, right? Geraldine Ferraro, any woman who's been strong has got that, well, wait a minute, double standard. You need to be strong to get there, but then we're not going to vote for you.
Yeah, and you might be too uppity.
There are very few jobs in the United States that are coded as masculine as the presidency, and politics is an extremely masculine sphere. And because we privilege that which is masculine in our society, that means then that we lose a great number of people who have very good skills, who are keenly analytical, who could do very well in the sphere of politics. But we lose many women who might enter that sphere because it is coded so masculine, because there is so much massaging and manipulation of the way in which people present themselves in public to get it to align with that masculine expectation of leadership, or that masculine expectation of what it means to be a fighting candidate. And so I think that perhaps Hillary Clinton is our most famous example of that, but it trickles on down through many, many different levels in the United States.
Are you seeing it in people in school, too? Can you tell who's going to be strong enough to stand up to it in your classrooms?
I think the interesting thing is, in the United States, girls have more leadership experience in elementary school through high school in terms of student government. And then as they leave high school and become more fully adult, there's a shifting, right, that ambition and leadership is, for many, many different reasons, it starts to sift out. And we see more men actually entering and winning in politics in general. But, of course, we saw after Anita Hill that there was a big upsurge of women.
Right.
And that potentially after the 2016 election, we might see another upsurge. And I know that is a big conversation around funding that is currently going on with candidates, especially from California.
Lizzie, in some of your notes that you provided for us in the program, what rang out for me was the fact that there's an assumption among Americans that we're a very progressive society, but in reality, in a lot of ways, we are very far behind the curve with regard to equal rights. Equal gender rights, if you will. It's pretty conspicuous. A major portion of the Western European and Northern Hemisphere countries have had high-ranking, if not top-ranking, leaders that are women, and we still haven't figured out how to do it.
Yes, we actually do not rank very well in terms of other whatever term you want to use, first world, industrialized, global north countries. And there are many countries that we might not consider in that realm that have far more women in their legislative bodies or in high-ranking political positions of power. And so I think that that raises the question of why. So Kennedy signs the Equal Pay Act in 1963. Right. Why do we still not have equal pay? Why do we still have legislators who say that they could not vote for or agree with equal pay legislation? And it comes down to power, right? So it comes down to one of the functions of gender in a society is to create unequal power relationships. And if we have a generation of young people who are starting to eschew these gender roles, then that may lead us to having a more equal society. If we change up what gender means in a society, then we will necessarily have to change up how we distribute power among our citizenry or among our population. And so
it makes me think of the workplace, because now we're getting paternity leave, and under the Family Medical Leave Act and other leaves, even for smaller employer groups here in California, you know, the men are allowed time off as well to nurture the child or to take care of the child. And I think as that happens more, maybe the women won't be seen as, oh, I can't hire her. She's going to have a baby. She's going to leave me high and dry. I'm hoping that that will help get that equality that you're talking about.
And a great deal of the research talks about how we must have a cultural change. So we have, as a society, we must change how it is that we think about gender. We must change how we think about masculinity. We must change how we think about femininity, about gender binary. And also we must have a policy change. We must have policies that support this, because the research shows that if you don't have a cultural change with a policy change, then peers police other peers on the job. So when it comes to maternity or paternity or parental leave of some nature, if there is not a policy change that supports that, then peers may police their other peers and say, you can't take that. Who's going to do your job? I'm going to be saddled with a bunch of extra work. And so to get a cultural change that values unpaid work, that values the work that we all must engage in to reproduce humanity, then means we would also have a shift of what it means to be paid workers, and it would mean we'd have to have a policy shift to support that.
Instead of one of the biggest military budgets in the world. Just saying, that's a choice that our government is making, is that they're putting the vast majority of our federal budget into the military-industrial complex, and we still don't have on a federal level maternity leave and things like that.
It's driven by power.
Those are choices that are being made, and in my view, I would say those are more traditional masculine choices.
Okay. I almost have to say quickly, though, that at the federal level, the law says people with 50 or more – businesses with 50 or more employees – have mandatory leave, 12 weeks for the mom and to have the birth. But any smaller group than that, they have trouble covering somebody's workload. They have trouble getting the cross training that's necessary and all. It really makes sense to me to have those be mandated only for larger companies, because it's on the business's side, it's really hard to run a business if you've got people leaving and you can't replace them.
Well, I'd give you a little shift on that, though. And I think a smaller organization probably has more employees that do crossover work. If I have a 200-person workforce and I have a series of departments and everybody does a certain job, it's less likely that someone in Department A is going to have any idea what somebody in Department C does.
Everybody's in their silos.
If I have 8 or 10 employees, probably my 8 or 10 employees all know what's going on everywhere.
Interesting.
And it's happening, right? Sure. It's happening in some northern European countries. And I guess I always feel like when it comes to anything, I mean, this is the United States of America.
We can do it.
If we can put a person on the moon, we can get maternity leave. That would be my take on it.
Okay. I think we can get back to this, too. We've got a caller here I want to get to. Kirsten in San Luis Obispo. Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I'm Kirsten, and I'm calling from Stand Strong, which is the new name for the Women's Shelter Program of Slo County.
Awesome. Yeah.
And I just wanted to say how much I really appreciate this conversation. It really, really resonates, given the work that we do here at Stand Strong around domestic violence, and particularly, I think, Lizzie's comments around what this has to do with power mean everything for our work. And I also want to say the piece about gender roles that you all were discussing a little earlier is really so important. I mean, we see it all day, every day in the work that we do in terms of, you know, how are we raising girls and boys in this society to grow up, and what are their expectations about their place in the world, their relationships with each other. And it's just a really powerful conversation. Of course, the end result of gender roles that are confining and outdated, the end result of that can be violence. And we see that all the time. And, of course, it's not just in heterosexual relationships, because, as I think you all have been pointing out, we're all affected by these gender roles. And so I just want to really thank you for that, and also say that I think there's a piece about accountability that's so important here. And I think about the Me Too movement and some of the stuff you all were referencing earlier, but you think about some of these high-profile cases and the things we've heard out of Hollywood, for instance, and, you know, there's a reason that these men were doing those things, you know, walking around in a bathrobe in front of your employees, or not in a bathrobe, in front of your employees. They did that because they knew they could get away with it. And I think as much as we can shift our culture toward one of accountability, which I'm hopeful is what's happening now, the better off we're all going to be.
Yeah. Kirsten, while you're here, that brings up a very good point that I'd maybe like you to chat about a little bit, and that is, one of the things that the Me Too movement has had thrown back at it is, gee, how come more women waited so long, in a lot of cases waited beyond the statute of limitation before they would report anything? The underlying fear, as I understand it, is the fear of the power that still comes after you. How do you hear from the people who come to you for assistance, they're able to break that cycle?
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, I think it goes back to accountability. In some ways, that's a question that answers itself, because the same people who are saying, well, gosh, why didn't they come forward earlier, are the same people who are saying, we don't believe her. Hmm. And we see that all the time in our work. And the reality is, we know our systems have a long way to go in terms of holding perpetrators accountable, whether it's this workplace stuff or whether it's the criminal justice system. I mean, we see it all the time that victims very often do not get the justice that they deserve, whether it's through our legal system or whatever the case may be. So there are all kinds of, unfortunately, very legitimate reasons why people hesitate to come forward. I think as a society, we have the idea that when folks come forward, everything changes and justice is served, and then she lives happily ever after. And unfortunately, we have all kinds of evidence that that is not the case. And that doesn't mean people shouldn't come forward, but it means there's a reason people take a good long time to think about that, because they know that's not always how it works. And in fact, it's not really often how it works, unfortunately. So I think this piece about accountability is not just in the individual setting, although that's vitally important too. It's at every level. So it's this company saying, we're not going to tolerate this, and you're out, because we've just gotten, you know, these credible reports, you know, and I'm not saying it's the slightest allegation you fire somebody, of course, but when there are these credible reports, then the company can enact some accountability there. We can do that in our individual spaces. If our neighbor or our brother-in-law or our friend is acting in these ways, we can be agents of accountability, and likewise our bigger systems, again, whether it's the courts or whatever it is, can also focus on accountability. And that's, I think, what's going to be a big part of changing this world. If there's a message across the board that, hey, this is not okay, and we as a society, or we as a community, or we as a family, or we as a neighborhood don't tolerate this.
Yeah.
Very good point. Thanks for the call.
Thank you. Appreciate the show.
Okay, we're running short on time, but Nancy, I wanted to give you a chance to get in here. So, Nancy from Cambria, you're on the air. I've got a very brief period of time. Go ahead.
Sure, Fred. I'll be really brief. I just want to say that
I don't know how many people know that the Equal Rights Amendment has never been passed.
Yes.
And we only need three more states to pass it and, or to ratify it for it to become part of our legal framework. And it would be a wonderful help to women in every way if that would happen. So I just think people should be aware of that and think about all the ramifications. If we had that behind us, we would have much better standing in the courts and
yes.
everything.
There's
thank you very much for the call.
A website, Equal Means Equal. It's really helpful yeah. in all of that. Equal Means Equal.
It's go really unbelievable that yeah. that has not been passed.
Yeah.
And it's almost 2018.
I know.
I just wanted to also just say one thing about sort of class and race that as it plays into this a little bit, that the Me Too movement, I think it was initiated by a black woman, so that's important to recognize. And a lot of the attention, though, has been around white, affluent, many of them famous women, and good for them for standing up, you know, no criticism there. But also it's just as important when a woman of color who's cleaning in a giant building by herself is sexually violated day after day after day. And so just wanted to make sure that we also recognize that those two things are equally unacceptable and horrible, and we need to stand with all of those women on all over the spectrum of class, especially in race.
Yeah, we're getting about towards the end. Anything else you want to add, Heidi?
Is this my final comment?
This is your final comment. Yeah, but we're down to about, you got about a minute for your
okay,
final
great.
Comment. Okay.
Well, you know, so I am the mayor, and I know you've said a couple times that you didn't want to make this political, but it's inherently political. And so we're still so far away from gender parity in elected office. Only about 20% of elected offices throughout the United States are held by women. And so we need people, and yes, I'm talking to you as you're sitting in your car or in your house or whatnot, to run for office. Women have to be asked to run for office 7 times before they'll consider it. So I'm asking you again, that's at least 2. Whereas many men, I think, don't even need to be asked whatsoever. They just have a different approach. And there's a lot of programs out there. Emerge California is one of them that does a training program for a year-long training program, and others that are getting off-the-charts applications this past year. So I would encourage you to consider it. Yes, it can be you. Don't wait till you're perfect. This is the perfect moment.
Okay, very good. Betsy.
Yeah, thank you. I just go back to the corny stuff that I grew up with. You know, are we going to be nice to each other or not? Are we going to realize the value of having as many different inputs of talent, many different kinds of talents, work toward a better workplace and a business and a society and a culture, or are we not? Why are we shooting ourselves in the foot by leaving half of the people out? Thinking about your person that you were talking about a minute ago, Heidi, so she was black plus she was a woman. That's mm-hmm. 2 strikes. Oh, wait, she was a maid or mm-hmm. cleaning. You're out.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody, I mean, some people don't respect.
Just get pushed out of the way.
There is no power there. I wanted to read a quote from this wonderful book, Uppity Women, the latest by Vicky Leon. Uppity Women Speak Their Minds. And this woman in 1870 said, "I ask no favors for my sex. All I ask of our brethren is that they will take their feet from our necks and permit us to stand upright on that ground which God designated us to designed, which God designed us to occupy." How long are we going to have to wait for that? Unbelievable. In the workplace and in society.
I don't know how long.
Come on. How
long? I don't
long?
Know how long we're going to wait.
No, we're done waiting. I'm done waiting.
Too long. Yeah,
you know,
I'll
it's,
give you that. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Lizzie.
I guess I would finish with, so I would really hesitate to classify sexual harassment or gender discrimination as a women's issue. And I think that we've
yes.
talked about it as a social issue, which is really important, because to frame it as a women's issue then puts the burden on women to fix the problem or to become more like men to avoid the problem, when really what we're talking about is the limitations and confining potential of gender roles in general, and especially around toxic masculinity. And then the second point that I would say is, when thinking about what do we do about it, what are some of the solutions, We should center those people who are the most vulnerable in our society, those people who are the most economically or socially vulnerable because of their sexuality or their racial and ethnic identity, their gender, because those people who are sort of the canary in the coal mines can – in liberating them from discrimination, then we liberate everyone. We liberate the privileged and we liberate the most oppressed. And then the third thing I would say, which is one of the things that I say to my students, is on this point of accountability that Kirsten referenced, which is now that we know, what do we do about it? If we choose to know and do nothing, then we are supporting the status quo. We are supporting, we are becoming complicit, the word of the year. And if we choose inaction, then that is an action in and of itself. So now that we know, what will our actions be to break down, to dismantle this social problem?
Love it.
Wow. Very good. Thank you. That becomes the last word on this topic for today, and I appreciate you leaving it with that. We've been doing this now for a number of weeks. We've been looking at this study from NPR. I want to thank everybody who's participated, those of you who've gone online and read the study, those of you who've called in or participated in the program. I want to leave it with the fact that it's obvious from the discussion today and the discussions we've had before that silence is not making any of this go away. The recurring theme we've had over the last 5 or 6 weeks dealing with this topic, both Chris Kington Barker and myself, was that silence does get you nowhere. And obviously my guests today have made it very clear that that assertively speaking what is the truth is going to be critical to moving us in directions we want to be in. And I thank you for all participating in this process. We've had a very, very rewarding experience looking at discrimination in America. And the key thing for this topic has been we've been looking at discrimination, not what people think they see of other people, but what they live with in their own lives. And I thank you for being part of that. Next week, Chris Kington Barker is going to be speaking with the founder and the CEO of the Savvy Leadership Academy, Maggie Von Stein, and members of her team, and they are going to discuss how the Savvy Leadership Academy endeavors to enhance and empower today's youth. The whole ability to have a handshake or a good eye contact or have a conversation seems to have gone by the wayside with way too many friends on Facebook and clever tweets back and forth. And the Savvy Leadership Academy looks at ways of working with youth to empower them to have better skills in overcoming barriers to become leaders because they've learned to be someone anonymous in our society. So that's Chris's program next week, and I think that you'll have a very enjoyable experience participating with that with her, and I'll be back with you in 2 weeks. I want to remind you that Central Coast Voices is a production of Action for Healthy Communities, which is a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. And that Vital Signs is a report that we put out every 3 years, and that can be found at actionslo.org for those who are interested in looking at what our society in the county locally is talking about. This program is underwritten by a grant from Joan Gellert Sargent, and we thank her for her support. You can reach us at voices@kcbx.org or by phone at 543-2323. I want to thank my guests today, Betsy, Heidi, and Lizzie, for a wonderful program. I hope you've been listening to all of the programs of this series. If you've missed any of them, they're archived on KCBX. You may want to go back. We've had some provocative and profound voices from our participants. Thank you. This has been Central Coast Voices.